men were involved in earlier this afternoon, and just the time that I've had to get to know several of you better. I appreciate the work that's going on here and the song leading instruction, everything that I was able to be a part of this evening. It's a tremendous encouragement to me. We found a text this morning in Hebrews chapter 12 that we're going to continue in. In Hebrews chapter 12, we noticed where the Lord exhorts us, the writer of Hebrews says, "Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." We began by looking at or asking the question, what do you want more than anything in life? And we observed the fact that in many cases, folks are not always honest about what they want. We know that we should want heaven more than anything else, but we don't always live like we do. We're not willing to do what it takes to get there and to attain to that heavenly home. So we challenged you this morning by pointing out that if we really do want heaven more than anything else, we will lay aside every hindrance or encumbrance. I believe that's what the New American Standard Version says, is encumbrance. We will lay aside every hindrance that would hold us back from finishing this race. We'll do what we have to be able to run with enough endurance that we can get there. Run that you may obtain it, Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Well, we talked about the fact that in running this race, weight equals hindrance, things that would hold us back, that if we desire to finish, we will lay aside whatever it is that's holding us back. A job, a relationship, a hobby, whatever it might be. But the key is, what do we really desire and value? And that's what we're going to be looking at in the study. It's not the thing in and of itself. We've already noted that we're looking at things that are not wrong in and of themselves. But when we value and prize that thing, when it becomes a treasure to us, then it becomes many times a weight in our life spiritually. And so we looked at the very first weight that I'd like to point out, and that is that desire for success in the estimation of this world. And that's going to not be necessarily wrong, but many times it's going to come at a great cost. In order to hold on to, in order to attain it in many cases, and in order to hold on to that success in the estimation of the world, we often have to compromise what God would have us to do. We may have to give up that worldly success, like Daniel was certainly had to be willing to give it up. Instead, he didn't compromise. He was faithful to his God, and God exalted him. Moses did have to give it up. Paul did have to give up that worldly success, and we may as well. We've also noticed the fact that today's society, that women are certainly being tempted to a large degree to enter into the workforce and to compete with men for that success, and it comes at a cost in many cases. If women understand and realize their first priority to God and they fulfill that priority, there are many other things that they can do. But our first pursuit, male or female, husband or wife, is to be successful in the role that God gave us, successful in God's eyes. We've got to understand too, husbands, that when we are putting that pressure on our wives to make more money so we can have more things and do more things, we're actually complicit in their spiritual breakdown. What we need to do is empower our wives to be the greatest woman that God intended for them to be, to fully fulfill whatever their talents and their abilities and their potential is. And we do that by providing the opportunities for them to serve God rather than crowding their lives with things that are our responsibility. And so then, as we finished, we noticed the fact that many are allowing their careers and their jobs to interfere with their duties and responsibilities and opportunities spiritually. We've got to make sure that we don't make the excuse that, well, my ox was in the ditch. If we have a job or a profession that is causing us to habitually forsake the assembly of the saints or to neglect the Lord or our families in any way, we need to get another job. We need to find another way to make our living. And we need to understand that thinking that there's going to be a time when it will be easy, that's a pipe dream. It's not going to happen. This life is a race. We're constantly laying aside these weights. Even as we get older, there are going to be new challenges that come up that we've got to simplify our life from time to time. This is all a part of this great, of the good fight that we fight, of the race that we run. So I want to go on then and make some application of a few other areas where I believe that we see ourselves weighed down. First of all, this is a very personal lesson, as I told you. I wondered why it was so hard to be a Christian. I felt like I was being pulled apart. And the real issue was that I was trying to hold on to too many temporal things. I identified these things in my life. When I finally realized this key and laid these things aside, it was liberating. It was incredible how much I grew spiritually without a care for these things. So I identified these things in my life, and I want to lay them out before you in this study. You may find the same challenges too. Along with that desire, remember where our treasure is, there our heart will be also. That desire, that for worldly friends, just like that desire for success in the eyes of this world. Worldly, I don't necessarily mean worldly in the standpoint that they are corrupt or worldly in a totally negative way. I'm just talking about people of this world. People that do not serve the Savior, Jesus Christ. People who don't have the same values, that do not share our faith and our love for the Lord. These people, in most cases, will be very worldly in their lifestyle. But the people that we come into contact every day with, every day at work, parents at school or in civic organizations, people who are of the world and not of the Lord. There is many times this insatiable desire to have people of the world approve of us and befriend us. We want to be liked by people. And listen, again, don't get me wrong. We don't need to try to make people of the world not like us. I'm not saying that. And there's nothing wrong if people of the world do appreciate us. They should respect us for the lives that we live. We want to be friendly. We're going to find some of our greatest prospects to bring people to Christ with those that we interact with in the world and have a good relationship with. I'm not opposed to that. What I'm talking about is where we're trying to be popular, if you will, with all the people out here in the world, or most of the people out here that do not share our faith. Whether we're talking about friends at school and peer pressure for young people, people at work or other moms in the organization or other wives in the particular business that we're in or whatever it might be. When we have that craving to be liked by the world, we're going to find that as being a very subjective target to try to hit. We can't please the world. I'll tell you that. We can't please God and please the world. We can be the kind of person God wants us to be, and people of the world who have an appreciation for the right kind of character will like us. They will appreciate those things, but we won't always please them. You know, in James chapter 4 and in verse 4, the Lord said in James 4 and in verse 4, "Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever, therefore, wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God." And I realize James is using the term world there in the sense of all things of this world, like John said in 1 John 2 and verse 15, do not love the world. Now, that doesn't love people who are not Christians, but that's talking about the world Satan controls. And we don't need to try to be a friend with that. We don't need to try to make peace with those forces that are opposed and against and fighting against Jesus Christ. There is a sense in which we need to, as much as lies within us, be at peace with all men, Romans chapter 12. But at the same time, we've got to understand that we are at war with Satan. And there are just some situations where we cannot make nice. We can't make everything to satisfy people of the world. So we've got to understand that trying to be a friend when there is a battle going on between Christ and these opposing forces of evil, it's not going to be successful. We've got to accept the fact that the world hated Jesus. There are going to be times when it hates us. You know, when we're talking about this idea of wanting to be approved of, wanting to find the favor of people of the world, I think about the challenge that comes when young people are dating other young people that are not Christians, people of the world. Because while there is certainly some great opportunity to study with people of the world that are your age, even young ladies to study with a young man, or young men to study with a young lady and to share the gospel with them. Great opportunities to do that. Dating is something that is different than that, though. I understand that a person can be dating and be studying at the same time. I realize that. But when we're talking simply about courting or about dating, we're talking about an arrangement or a relationship, if you will, where two people are obviously attracted to one another, they're interested in one another, and their emotions are being stirred up where they're beginning to fall in love or to care about this particular person. When all of that is happening at the same time that you're trying to study over here, that makes for sometimes a difficult dynamic, and many of you have probably been involved in that, trying to study with someone that you're emotionally involved with or falling with, and those emotions, it's hard to separate them. You know, when we're studying the Bible, we want to do so objectively, not subjectively. We want to be dispassionate in our approach to truth and to seek the truth. But when we're invested in somebody like that, it makes it a lot more difficult. So I'm talking about when we are having this relationship that is building and developing a consideration for another person, caring for another person, falling in love with another person, and that person is not a Christian. They don't share our faith. Somebody says, well, Brad, is that wrong? Well, I'm not able to make a blanket statement and say that it's wrong, but I do want you to think about the dangers that are there and how there can be a tremendous hindrance to you spiritually to be dating and falling in love with somebody who does not share the same values, who does not share the same Lord that you that you serve. Well, I know a lot of people in this world claim to serve Jesus Christ, but all they've done is create a God that likes what they like, says they can do what they want to do, and they've named him Jesus Christ. I want you to realize that. They say they serve the Lord. Oh, I believe in Jesus. Well, the Jesus they believe in says it's all right for them to drink socially and get drunk sometimes. The Jesus they serve says it's okay to dress immodestly. The Jesus they serve says it's all right to have an intimate relationship outside if you love one another. Now, hold on a minute. They obviously don't know or serve Jesus whom we serve, right? And so that's why when a person claims to be a Christian and they believe in Jesus, I want to tell you, sometimes they don't mean what you mean by that. Once a person starts dating someone of the world, are there going to be challenges? Certainly. 1 Corinthians 15 and in verse 33, do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits. I know that that's written in a context that pertains to false teachers, actually, concerning the resurrection, but it's a general truth. Evil company corrupts good habits or lifestyle. It's going to impact you. And I know that many times the attitude is, oh, no, you don't understand. I'm being a good influence on them. I believe you. You probably will have a good influence on them. But you know what? If they're worldly, if they don't share your values, do you know what's going to happen? They're going to have an influence on you too. You know, when you pour hot water and cold water together, you get thermal equilibrium. The hot influences the cold, and the cold influences the hot, don't they? And that's what happens in a relationship. It's not one-sided. And you can't afford to be influenced in that way. Proverbs 12 and in verse 26, the Bible says, the righteous should choose his friends carefully, for the way of the wicked leads them astray. I want to tell you, not in any other relationship is this more true than in the person that you're dating and falling in love with and eventually marry. But I want to tell you, I'm willing to take a step back from marriage and just talk about dating. You fall in love with somebody. I mean, not even married to them yet. You become attracted to and interested in this person, caring about them, and eventually at least feeling like you're in love with this person. They're going to have a tremendous influence over you. There's not anyone in this world that you're going to want to please or impress more than that person that you care about in that way. That's what gives them that power over you. It's a wonderful thing when you're in love with someone who loves the Lord, because you need to be selfless with that person. But when that person doesn't love the Lord the way the Bible describes, then there's going to be a tremendous conflict in your life. You know, a gospel preacher at one point did a survey. He simply sat down and considered those that he knew who had married Christians and the outcome of their lives spiritually, and those that he knew who had married non-Christians. And he had been preaching quite a number of years, and enough years that he was able to look back and to make note of different Christians he had been involved with who had gotten married. And among those who had married Christians, there were 112 total. Eight of those fell away. Eight of those Christians that he had known who had married another Christian fell away from the Lord, about 7% of them. And it's certainly a tragic thing. It can definitely happen. You know, sometimes we talk about, you need to marry a Christian, you need to marry a Christian. Well, there's a lot more to it than that, than somebody who goes to church and who's been baptized. That's not what I tell my kids. You need to marry someone who is wholly, completely devoted to the Lord, not just wearing the name Christian. And I want you to understand, I'm not saying that you simply need to go out here and find somebody who goes to church and then everything's okay. And as opposed to who's not a Christian, who may obey the gospel and be an outstanding mate, have parents that kind of character. No, one preacher said one time, and I concur with this, I'd rather my daughter marry a Cornelius than a Diotrephes. And what I mean by that is, Cornelius wasn't a Christian, but he had the right character and the heart to become one. Diotrephes was a member of the church. Why, he was horrible. I don't want to marry someone like that. So, but when we're looking at this, it certainly happens. But out of that 112, 104, obviously, 93% remained faithful to the Lord. Four ended up divorced. Broken homes do happen, even among Christians. But 4% of those were divorced. Now, among those who married non-Christians, he could think of 149. That troubles me that there were more Christians that he could think of that married non-Christians than who married Christians. But nonetheless, out of 149 who married non-Christians, 106 of those left the Lord. 71% lost their soul. Now, this didn't even take into account those who didn't fall away, 43 who remained faithful, 29%, but still lost their children. See, there's a whole lot more to this picture than what's being represented here. There may be a person who marries a non-Christian that doesn't fall away, but their mate never obeys the gospel, and let's say they have four children and three of them never become Christians. How many times have we seen that? I want to tell you, I've seen it more than not, because of the influence of that mate who's not a Christian. But 71%. It's not they lost their marriage. I mean, there were certainly those who ended up divorced. 30% as opposed to 4. 44 of them ended up divorced. But I'm not just talking about who lost their marriage. I'm talking about those who lost their soul. 71%. You know, if I were to approach you this week and to say, you know, I'm also working and involved in financial planning, and I would like for you to consider investing with me, and I've got some mutual funds I'd like to help you with, and I'd like to take care of your retirement. You say, well, all right, Brad, have you been doing this long? Oh, yeah, several years. Well, how well are you doing? What's your success rate? Well, I've had about 71% of my customers lose everything. I mean, they lost all their retirement, but I've had a 29% success rate. How many of you would invest your retirement? And yet your return can compared to your soul. Can't even fathom why a person would be willingly go down this road. You know what's going to happen? Somebody's going to come up and tell me tonight. Happens every meeting. Well, here's a person that I married that wasn't a Christian, and it's going to be someone who is now a faithful, staunch member of this congregation. Wonderful. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm just telling you, don't be prideful and think that it's a good thing to do. I actually had, in a gospel meeting, was preaching this sermon, and after the sermon, the preacher's wife came up, several young girls around her. She said, "Brett, you know what happens when you marry a non-Christian?" I said, "I think I do," and she pointed to her husband, the local preacher there. And here are these young girls around her. I said, "No, ma'am, that's not what normally happens. God forbid that you would influence other young girls to take such a risky decision, or young boys for that matter. This isn't just about girls. This is men and women who married non-Christians. 71% fell away." I tell you, brethren, this is a real and a serious danger that we need to take into account. Look with me in Joshua chapter 23. And remember God's warning to them. We see the passage in Deuteronomy 7, verses 3 through 4. "Nor shall you make marriages with them, for they will turn your sons away from following me." Notice in Joshua, as he closes his instruction to the people, again, just like Moses did in Deuteronomy, Joshua wanted to remind the people of the dangers that were there. In Joshua 23 and in verse 11, "Therefore take careful heed to yourselves that you love the Lord your God, or else if indeed you do go back and cling to the remnant of these nations." He's talking about their relationships with people of the world. Excuse me. He says, "And cling to these nations, these that remain among you, and make marriages with them, and go in to them, and they to you. Know for certain that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations from before you, but they shall be snares and traps to you, and scourges on your sides, and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land which the Lord your God has given you." Thorns in your eyes. Young people, I want you to realize that being in love with someone, married to someone who doesn't love the Lord, who is not one with you in this, will be a misery in your life if you constantly strive to be close to the Lord. Now, what some people have done, obviously 71% in this particular test case, is pull away from the Lord and the Lord's people to be able to be closer to that person and to have less conflict. But that's the wrong direction. That's going to take your life eternally. That's going to destroy your soul. He says it will be like thorns in your eyes. There are people you could talk to today that I know that while they certainly love their mate, they will tell you that their life, it has been like thorns in their eyes, the conflicts that they've had over their faith, over their children, and the heartbreak of children who've either never obeyed the gospel or fallen away as a result of the influence of that other mate. Yes, you need to realize the danger that is there. And dating someone, and here's another very important point. What everyone says is, well, they're going to obey the gospel. I'm going to teach them the truth. Of those who married non-Christians, 18% were successful at that. That's not a very good rate, is it? I wouldn't take 18%. The thing is, you marry who you date. You fall in love with this person, it's going to influence you. It is going to affect you. It's going to have an impact on you. Because you care about that person and you're going to want to please them. You know, what happens is once we try to please people of the world, one of the only ways we can do that is to become like them, to be interested in the same things. In 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 17, the Lord said, "Therefore come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean and I'll receive you." We don't need to become more like the world to draw the world. We need to be more like Christ. That's how we're going to draw the honest souls. We need to be separate from the world so that we can reach the world. In 1 Peter chapter 3 and in verse 15, he says, "Sanctify the Lord God in your hearts and always be ready to give a reason or a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear." I want to know, why would someone ask us a reason for the hope that is within us if we dress like them, use the same language as them, go to the same movies, entertain ourselves in the same way? They wouldn't see anything different in us to ask us a reason for the hope within us. That's the problem in too many churches today, is that there is not a difference. The fact is, the church needs to be changing the world, not the church changed by the world. Titus 2 and verses 11 through 14, we should be His own peculiar people. But notice with me also another area where we find ourselves weighed down and hindered, and that is in the desire for pleasure or fun, entertainment. Certainly nothing wrong with entertainment or hobbies or things that we do for recreation. But the problem is that some people cannot let go of their recreation. And in 2 Timothy chapter 3, Paul speaks about perilous times that will come. He said in verse 1, "But know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good." Listen to verse 4. "Traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God." That's what's happening to people. Pleasure or entertainment or recreation is not inherently wrong, but where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. There are people that are falling in love with their hobbies and their entertainment and their pastimes, so much so that they are pulling away from the Lord. They're lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. And Paul simply says that they have a form of godliness, but denying its power. And from such people turn away. Yes, there is a facade of Christianity that's there, but they're not devoted to the Lord. They love their interests. They love their hobbies too much. W.R. Jones in the gospel meeting many years ago, I remember him talking about entertainment and recreation and all the stuff that we get our kids involved in. He said, "You know, recreation's kind of like an electric wire. You get a hold of it, and then it gets a hold of you. You know, that's the way electricity works. You get a hold of a live electric wire, and you can't let go of it, even though you want to and you need to, until it electrocutes you." That's what happens to some Christians with their recreation. We're a very prosperous society. And as we work hard and live right and do well, we continue to prosper and we get more things. And with more things, there's more upkeep with those things. Sometimes somebody goes out and maybe buys a boat. And they think, "You know, I spent so much money on this boat, I need to be using it." And so they get out on the weekends and they take it out on the water and they realize, "Well, you know, I mean, we're only getting one day out of this thing. It's not really worth our money." So then they decide that they're going to stay open on Sunday and spend more time and maybe worship somewhere where they're vacationing and things like that. And they become less and less involved or a part of the work of the local church that they're a member of. It's because they've bought into that hunger for recreation and fun. Nothing wrong with a boat or fishing or skiing or all those things. I'm not saying that. I'm just one example. And I've felt this feeling. I'm an avid hunter. And I find times where I realize, "Brett, you're thinking too much about, you're spending too much time thinking about these various hunts or this or that or what you want to get next or where you're going hunting next time." And sometimes I've got to put the magazines up. I've got to leave the hunting channel off, not even turn to it. I've got to lay aside that weight sometimes because I don't care who we are or what the entertainment is. It's constantly trying to take control of us. And, you know, here's the thing about entertainment and pleasure and fun and recreation. Recreation's a positive thing. Think about that word, recreation. We need to have some downtime. We need to have some fun. All of us need to do that. We'll be healthier emotionally, healthier physically. I believe we'll be healthier spiritually. But the problem with recreation is kind of like with dessert. You know, sweets are good. Some people would argue with that. Dessert, I'll say, is good in the right proportion. You know, if it's up to my kids, they would eat dessert for their main course, and they would eat a little bit of what mom fixes for dinner. Well, that's not healthy, is it? You know, in the right proportion. And this is what happens to us with recreation. We realize, wow, I needed that. I enjoyed that. I was needing some downtime. I was needing to have some fun. So we try to have more and more and more, and pretty soon we're having dessert for supper. And that's not healthy for us. We need the right balance of work and of that recreation. What's happening to us is as we're becoming a more prosperous society, we can afford to work less and play more. And we're trying to make sure that our kids get to do what we didn't get to do. Well, you know, in some areas that might be fine. But I want to tell you, it wasn't bad for us as kids to work more. It was a good thing. And the best memories I have is helping my dad build fence, or when we worked cattle, or those times that we worked together are the best memories that I have with my dad. He was teaching me how to work on a car when he was working on his, and I was helping him, handing him to those things. Those are good memories for me. And dads, we need to be teaching our boys to be providers and take care of a family. And moms, our daughters need to be taking care of the family and doing those domestic chores. And taking our kids to gospel meetings, singing hymns on the way, and all of the things that we can do of a spiritual nature, that's the most important thing, and help them to understand that balance. My kids are involved in sports, don't get me wrong, and I enjoy it, I love it. But we've got to make sure that we are finding that balance and not keeping our kids so busy that they can't learn godliness. I want to tell you, the prosperity that we enjoy in our society, there are parents trying to live through their kids is what they're doing. Their kids are in every sport. They travel to this game, that game, and the other. They're spending enormous amounts of money on it. And you know what I see? I see stressed out kids. It quits being fun because all they do is practice and play games, and they've got this level and that level and this tournament and that tournament. And I know that there's certainly some kids that enjoy that, but a lot of kids are stressed out and they're too busy to study their Bibles. What we're teaching our children when we do this is self-indulgence. I got to have more fun, have more entertainment, have more recreation. That was the Achilles heel of Samson. You look at him in Judges 14 and in verse 3, his father and mother said to him, "Is there no woman among the daughters of your brethren or among all my people that you must go and get a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines?" Samson said to his father, "Get her for me. She pleases me well." We see the contrast between Esau and Moses. Esau, in Hebrews 12 and in verse 16, was considered a profane man who for one morsel of food sold his birthright. See that? The temporal. Enjoyment right now. But on the other hand, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Hebrews 11, 24 through 26. The difference between self-indulgence and those who would rather suffer affliction with the people of God as Moses than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Verse 26, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasure in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. That's what we've got to learn to do more, and quit trying to have our reward here and now. I want to tell you what a lot of people are chasing in this, all the sports and recreation and entertainment. Nothing wrong with those things in the right balance. But people are getting swallowed up in these things, and a lot of Christians are doing this. It's wholesome fun. They think as long as it's not sin, I can do all I want. They don't understand the principle of Hebrews chapter 12. And then also, and finally, a desire for wealth. This is another one that gets so many Christians caught up in it. And I know we talked about a desire for success and the estimation of men, but I also want you to think about this desire for wealth, not just success, but I want more possessions. I want more things. I want more money. Again, wealth is not inherently evil, but the desire for wealth is a tremendous weight. In Proverbs chapter 23, I want you to turn over there with me, if you will, and notice in verse 4, the wise man in Proverbs chapter 23 And in verse 4, he simply says, labor not to be rich. Because of your own understanding, cease. Will you set your eyes, verse 5, will you set your eyes on that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away like an eagle toward heaven. He's saying this is an elusive dream. Labor not to be rich. That's the King James Version translation. The New King James says, do not overwork to be rich. It is the idea of exhausting oneself. And brethren, I see Christians everywhere, in nearly every church, that are exhausting themselves trying to have just a little bit more. Just a little bit more. You say, well, Brett, that's the American dream. Look, I understand. There is nothing wrong with enjoying the fruit of our labor, working hard and being rewarded for that. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. But don't do it for the sake of satisfying a craving for money. You know why? Because the eye is never satisfied with silver, the writer of Ecclesiastes says. We will never gratify that desire. We can scratch that itch all day long and it'll never be satisfied. There will always be that hunger for more. We are not to crave after more money. Listen to what Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 6. He makes it very clear here the inherent dangers that are there. While money is not inherently wrong, there are inherent dangers. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 9. Listen, you know, we said the key is what you treasure, where your heart is, the desire for wealth. Listen to verse 9. He says in 1 Timothy chapter 6, in verse 9, but those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts which drown men in destruction. For the love of money, there's the idea of love in your heart and your treasure, for the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. It's that craving for more. The idea is that if I can have more money, if I can have more wealth, then I'll be happy. Then I will accomplish what I feel like I need or want. In Luke 12, we read earlier about the foolish but wealthy farmer who tore down his barns and built bigger barns. Instead of being rich toward God, he tried to amass all of this to serve himself. He was hungry for that wealth. You know, somebody says, well, Brett, Abraham was rich and Job was rich. Well, that's right. And I'm not saying that it's inherently wrong to be wealthy. I know many very faithful Christians who are incredibly wealthy, but they have not put their wealth before their Lord. Now, when I say wealthy, here's the thing that is deceitful about this. When we compare ourselves to about 90% of the world, we're all wealthy. I mean, we live higher economically than by far the greater percentage of this world's population. We're all wealthy. We tend to always think that it's that guy that's wealthy. I'm not wealthy. I'm just getting by. I'm just paying my bills. No, what you're doing is as your standard of living, as your wealth increases, you raise your standard of living to where you're always just getting by. You increase your bills. You increase your standard of living to where it costs more. Then you feel like you're not wealthy. Satan is good at what he does. He ought to be. He's been doing it for thousands of years. But he's so deceitful, he makes us think that I'm not rich. I'm not wealthy. I just need a little bit more. It's that craving for more that gets us. Yes, Abraham was wealthy. But in Genesis 24 and in verse 35, he acknowledged, or his servant did, that God was the one that made him rich. And I'll tell you another thing. When you want to compare yourself to Abraham, live in a tent as a traveler for most of your life, and then you can compare yourself to Abraham. Yes, he was wealthy. He didn't own his land. He wandered around like a pilgrim. I'll tell you, there were a lot of sacrifices he made for the Lord, and yes, the Lord gave him great possessions. Job was a wealthy man, but he also lost it all. And he praised God, and he said, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. These men were wealthy and they were faithful. Their craving was not for the wealth. they pursued the Lord. They let the Lord make them as wealthy as the Lord was satisfied to make them. The fact is that it can certainly restrict our path to heaven. In Matthew chapter 19, Jesus encountered a wealthy young man. And in verse 24, Jesus said, "It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God." That's all about hindrance, isn't it? It is. I've heard brethren for years try to rationalize this and explain it away and say, well, that he didn't mean a camel and a needle. He was talking about, well, it was a gate in the wall and the animal had to get on its knee. Look, this is a figure of speech. It's called hyperbole. It's like me saying, I'm so hungry I could eat a horse. Somebody said, well, he didn't mean a horse. Yeah, I did. I meant a horse. I was exaggerating to prove a point. And that's what Jesus is doing here. And his point is, yes, it's a challenge. In Mark 4 and in verse 19, in the parable of the sower, Jesus said, "And the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches and the desires for other things enter in and choke the word." Mark 4 and verse 19. Yes, there are hindrances that go along with this. We need to set aside that desire. We need to do our work, be content with such things as we have, serve the Lord and let Him bless us as He knows we are fit and able to handle. It is this craving, though, that is a weight to many. Well, so what does that mean? Why do we need to lay aside these weights? Well, let's go back to our text as we finish this evening. In Hebrews chapter 12, he says in verse 1, he says, "Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run." We need to be able to run as Christians. Too many Christians are crawling. They're just barely inching along. Some of them are stationary. They're not growing anymore. They're not changing. They're not still transforming. They've just stopped. He says, you need to run. Don't walk. Spiritually, you need to be growing and transforming every day. And I want to tell you, I am certain that one of the greatest reasons that Christians are in that stalemate is because of all the worldly barnacles, you know, all the weights that have stuck to them, and they haven't laid them aside. We need to run like our examples. Look back in chapter 11. That's the context of this statement in chapter 12. When he says, therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, what's he talking about? All of those people in Hebrews 11, those great men and women of faith, they are witnesses giving testimony to the fact that you need to lay aside every weight. You need to run with endurance. Look at what they did. Verse 25, he talks about Moses suffering affliction. As you go on down, he says in verse 33, through faith subdued kingdoms. Verse 34, quenched the violence of fire. And then in verse 36, others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were slain with the sword, they wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented. How did they do it? I'll tell you, they couldn't do it holding on to all the temporal affairs of this life. It could not happen. We need to run, and we need to run with endurance. That means that we're not knocked over by the slightest problem at church, by the slightest insult, or by this discouragement or that discouragement. We run with endurance. These things are happening. We keep running. We keep running. We have the endurance. That's not slowing me down. We're not hitting that wall. We keep running, and we endure in serving the Lord. We need to be prepared for persecution. Look in 2 Timothy 2. This is another very pertinent passage that, along with Hebrews 12, was so powerful to me in its application. 2 Timothy 2 and in verse 4. No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life that he may please him who enlisted him as a soldier. You know, I understand the idea of a soldier. They just have their necessities here. They have a bunk. They don't have all of their things around them. They're in war. And they're ready at a moment's notice to go and fight. He says, a soldier doesn't entangle himself with the affairs of this life. He is single-minded. He is focused on the matter at hand. He says that's the way that we need to be as Christians. I find myself too many times getting entangled in the wholesome and not wrong, but pretty soon they're just weighing me down and I need to simplify my life and lay aside these weights. And when we are free from that, we're prepared for fight that good fight. We're ready to finish that race. That's why we need to lay them aside, brethren. How do we do it? Look again at our text. Verse 2. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. Hebrews 12 and verse 2. Who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Look at his example. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross. You see that despise the shame? That word despise means to think little of. He didn't care. It didn't bother him. You know, you take a senior in high school. If an eighth grader or a freshman comes up and makes fun of what they're wearing, does that bother them? A senior doesn't care what a freshman thinks. They may go rub their face in the grass or something, you know? And so the Lord doesn't care what the world's estimation of them is. This is how we overcome peer pressure. This is how we overcome these challenges in life. We despise the shame. Look at his teaching. In Matthew 18, in verses 8 through 9, if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. If your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. Cast it far from you. Why? It's better to enter into life maimed than to enter into hell having both hands or both eyes. We've got to understand that the Lord is serious about things like this. When we read a verse like that, does he mean it? You know, it boggles my mind that we can read a passage like Matthew 18 telling us that we need to cut off our hand or pluck out our eye, whatever it takes in order to get to heaven. And then somebody says, Brett, you've been talking about laying aside every weight and my job keeping me from the assembly of the saints. Do you think the Lord really wants me to quit my job and find another one? No, but if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. But don't quit your job. Really? You think that the Lord wants us, tells us, and again, I understand that this is a figure of speech as well. We're not going to have to pluck out our eye to get to heaven, but what he's saying is, even if you did, it would be the best thing to do. Yet, he would expect us to find another job, or to find a different person to date, or to choose to marry someone who's going to help me get to heaven rather than hinder me from getting to heaven. Yes, the Lord would expect me to do that. You know, when we picture Jesus in Matthew 27, having gone through that horrible trial and mocking, people spitting in his face, slapping him in the back, beating him over the head with a rod, scourged until his back is a bloody mess, and then nailed to a cross. And people have the audacity to say, does the Lord mean that, do we have to come on Sunday night and Wednesday night too? You know, when you see Jesus hanging on the cross and you ask a question like that, you cannot even be close to grasping what Christianity is all about. Jesus said, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. Are we willing to do that? Or are we just playing church like little kids? Just coming to church, putting on a good show, but we're going to take care of what we want to do first. Is that what it's all about? Because if it is, then just admit it. You don't want to go to heaven more than anything else. You're going to church to maybe impress other people. I don't know. I don't know what your purpose is. You're not getting to heaven. No way, if we're not willing to lay aside anything and everything in order to get there. Jesus was willing to lay aside his own family members. My mother and my brothers, my sisters, those who do the will of God. No relationship, nothing in this life would keep him from doing that. So do you really want to finish? Weight equals hindrance. It may not be inherently sinful, but it's not helpful to you spiritually. If you desire to finish, you'll shed that weight. The key is the desire. Do you want to get to heaven? If you haven't obeyed the gospel, you need to begin by believing in Jesus as the Son of God, confessing your faith in Him, repenting of your sins, and being buried in the water of baptism for the remission of sins. You can do that tonight. All things are ready. And if as a child of God, you've been weighed down, you've been hindered, maybe you've completely left the racetrack, come back to the Lord. If you need our for you, but whatever your need is to make yourself right with God and be ready to enter into heaven, if the Lord should come back tonight, you need to do that and let us help you with it. Whatever that need is, please make it known and come forward as we stand and sing the invitation song.